Mrs. Knight, Mr. Hiller.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Matt Hiller on behalf of Petitioner Appellant Thomas Phil Moore. Mr. Moore wishes to emphasize three areas of the arguments he raised in his briefs. First, that his 2254 petition was timely filed in the Northern District of Indiana. Although,
can I ask you one technical point about the record? The allegations made that on April 19, 2002, the Indiana Supreme Court denied Mr. Moore's petition to transfer from his post-conviction, and that somehow isn't in the record. Is it clear that Mr. Moore, in fact, asked the Indiana Supreme Court to take that case and they denied the petition?
There are no papers in the record evidencing that he filed a petition for transfer. The site in our briefs refers to Judge Judge Sharp's decision in this case, but the record on appeal does not evidence that he did in fact seek a petition for transfer.
And isn't this because Judge Sharp issued a rather strange order saying that nobody had to file the state court record in this case?
I don't believe I have not seen that order. Judge Sharp did deny our motion to supplement the record with the record below. It was not part of the record on appeal when this case originally came to this court.
But how can you do a habeas case without having the state court record
in front of you? We don't believe that he could, in fact, do the case. He dismissed it because Moore's petition was untimely.
But even the timeliness argument you're making is influenced by what happened, certainly, in the state court. And there's a separate and independent reason to be concerned about whether the Indiana Supreme Court was presented with and then denied the motion to transfer, namely O'Sullivan against Burkle. If no one ever asked them, and if he never asked them, he's got other problems that might preclude his case.
That's correct, Your Honor. We relied on Judge Sharp's finding, and we did not challenge the fact that the record was not properly before. We believe it was not within the scope of our certificate of appealability, and we believe on this issue of timeliness, this should still go back to Judge Sharp, and those actions could be remedied at that time, or those lack of actions could be remedied at that time.
But even if we were to agree with you on timeliness, and you certainly can come back to that point, I don't see where any argument about Brady has been preserved in this case. The Supreme Court has recently, in Baldwin against Reese, emphasized that it really wants clear presentation of the state courts. There's just nothing there.
You're correct, Your Honor, that Moore never raised Brady through his state post-conviction, through his direct appeal, his state post-conviction, or even in the district court here. He did raise the transaction of facts, meaning that his trial counsel failed to discover exculpatory evidence.
But aren't these two really different things? I mean, I thought the word actually used was present. And if trial counsel gets the open file from the prosecutor and is simply negligent in reading through it and then maybe never even bothers to read through it, not that I'm saying this is what this man did, but if that's what happened, then you would have a potential ineffective assistance of counsel argument, and you could present that to the state courts and get it litigated. If the problem, to the contrary, is that the prosecutor over there is not diligent about collecting all of the information from the various law enforcement agencies and thus fails in his responsibility under the Supreme Court's Brady jurisprudence, it's just a really different claim. And I realize our certificate of appealability mentioned Brady, and I'm nonetheless concerned that there has been proper preservation at such a point.
Moore had no ability to discover his Brady claim until the post-conviction hearing on August 24, 2000, in which his trial counsel testifies that he may not have seen the exculpatory police exhibits. While that's not a resounding failure to, or a suppression argument, the counsel does say, if you didn't get the exhibits from me, then I may not have seen them.
But is that specific enough, A, for us to be confident that this information was not in the file? It's a very vague statement. And secondly, the state also argues that roughly equivalent evidence was before the jury. I'm not even sure why we need to assume Mr. Moore's driving the same car, or the perpetrator, whoever it is, you know, is driving the same car that night as that individual drives the rest of the time. So I'm not positive that this location of the antenna matters too much.
The sufficiency of the suppression is supported by other facts other than just, I may not have seen this. In fact, Moore tendered copies of the exculpatory police reports to his counsel during direct examination.
What's exculpatory about them? I don't understand that.
The exculpatory nature is that the victim identified the perpetrator as having blue eyes. At trial, she was unable to identify any facial features of the perpetrator. In addition, Moore's counsel was unable to emphasize those areas.
Yeah, but I mean, but this wasn't, he wasn't convicted on the basis of her identifying him. Let me ask you this. Why was he arrested in the first place? Since the evidence against him is kind of evidence that would be collected after a person was arrested. So
it's not in the record, Your Honor, as to why he was arrested. He was arrested, I believe, because he had been arrested for a previous police impersonation rape in a separate county. That is his other conviction and the mechanism in which he did
that. Was that evidence introduced here?
That evidence was not, in fact, after he was convicted in this case, that case was retried, that case had been overturned, and they attempted to use the evidence of this conviction in that case, which also resulted in that case being overturned again. So between his two convictions, I believe he's had three or four reversals. Maybe three. Reversed.
Any of them based on ex parte communications by the judge with the jury?
No, Your Honor. None of the reversals have been based on the ex parte. The reversal in this case was based on the fact that the prosecutor criticized Moore for failing to take the stand in support of his alibi defense during closing arguments. The Indiana Court of Appeals, in a rather short opinion, reversed that conviction. The Indiana Supreme Court, however, reaffirmed for
now. Why was his other police impersonation conviction reversed?
The original one, unfortunately, I cannot recall. The second one was reversed because they stated the prosecution improperly used Rule 404B evidence of his conviction in this case, which the crime happened after the original crime.
There isn't really much doubt about his guilt, though, is there?
I believe there is. The evidence, the physical evidence, if you compare the physical
fingerprints on her driver's license?
The fingerprint issue is not as strong as it may seem. The Indiana Crime Lab looked at the driver's license, was not able to find fingerprints, and I believe actually testified at trial they found no fingerprints. However, 2 years later, the FBI was able to...
Yeah, but it's the FBI that is the repository of expertise in fingerprinting, not the Indiana State Police, whatever they are.
Absolutely, but I believe the technician that looked at his had a specialty in fingerprint technology, and the FBI's investigation could be questioned. I believe they only had Moore's fingerprints to compare. They didn't do a random analysis of all the fingerprints of the other suspects, which is important here because two of the suspects were police officers in investigating agencies.
Could I, before you run out of time, just comment that with respect to your ex parte communication point, you're really fighting an uphill battle, it seems to me, when you try to say that it's not subject to harmless error analysis, which is what it's really in part gone off on, since this court seems to have said that precisely this sort of thing is, not that our view is dispositive, but how could it be unreasonable for the state courts to take that view?
You're correct. This court has said that ex parte communications are
not
structured.
We must be unreasonable along with the state courts if that's not the law.
Well, because your difficulty here is you don't have any record of what was the ex parte communication consisted of.
That's correct. And the state courts improperly focused on the testimony of the jury. And I believe my time may have expired. The state court here in post-conviction, when first looking at the ex parte communication issue, emphasized the fact that the jurors who testified at the post-conviction hearing stated that they weren't biased by the transaction with the judge. Unfortunately, the jurors had imperfect information and don't understand the importance of preventing ex parte communications, and they may have been given false testimony nullifying one of Moore's alibi witnesses. So it's tough to put importance on the, or value on the jury's testimony.
Hard to say it's harmless error unless you know what the error was.
That's absolutely correct, and that's why we looked at Delgado versus Rice. Although not precedential, it did look at a somewhat analogous situation. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Martin. Mr. Martin?
May it please the court. This court should affirm the district court. The district court properly found this petition barred by the statute of limitations.
Now, Mr. Martin, I have a problem with that, and I also have a problem with the absence of anything from the state record in this record, including this critical April 19, 2002 order. Now, are you conceding that the Indiana Supreme Court did, in fact, on April 19, 2002, deny Moore's petition to transfer?
Your Honor, that is correct.
So we can take the fact that both sides agree as the equivalent of compliance with O'Sullivan against Burkle.
That's right, Your Honor. And in the return, I'm sorry, before this court, it was not, that evidence was not highlighted. It is in the return to the order to show cause that we filed in the district court. The docket for the post-conviction matter reflects the filing of the transfer petition and the court's denial of
it. So we'll get a docket number, and I mean, do we have any of that information before us?
It should have been transferred, I believe, from the district court to this court with our pleading, our return to the order to show cause and the exhibits that were included therein.
Okay, I mean, the reason I stress it is it's a procedural prerequisite to being able to go forward with a habeas petition. The Supreme Court was addressing exactly the issue whether these discretionary decisions by state supreme or opportunities to get review from the state Supreme Court were part of the process, and it said, yes, it is part of the process.
He did attempt to get discretionary review from the state Supreme Court, Your Honor.
Now, the second thing that concerns me is that in terms of this timeline, he is, after all, in prison, and he doesn't get, I mean, he can't just frivolously come along and say, I think there was a problem with the jury, and file a petition, because he would be thrown out immediately, and of course then he gets into all sorts of second or successive petition problems. You need to have at least a certain factual grounding, and it's hard for me to say, before he gets the letter from Storms on May 18, 1998, that he has enough to go forward. That's when he's got the two affidavits. And Stevens, Dono and Stevens sign their affidavits. He's obviously trying to stay with it with Storm. Why are you stressing timeliness so much when you have these merits issues?
Well, Your Honor, I would agree that the merits of the issues for petitioner fail to warrant relief. But the timeliness is, of course, a prerequisite procedural matter. And here, the record supports only the conclusion.
Who is this fellow Storm? Is he a private detective or something, or is he just a pal of Moore's? Or
Your Honor, I believe that
the Maris or what?
I believe he is more the latter, a friend of Mr. Moore's. That Mr. Moore, as I understand it, Your Honor, Mr. Moore had been contacted by Mr. Storms after Mr. Storms claimed to have overheard juries talking, and the record just suggests that Mr. Storms alerted Mr. Moore that he believed that that conversation indicated that they'd been improperly led somehow and that he was going to investigate.
And that's why you get into this subpart B question of section 2244. This is obviously not the kind of evidence that could have been available before the trial, right? You know, because it's about the trial process. And it's obviously not the kind of thing that Mr. Moore was in any position to investigate once he's behind bars. They have to rely on somebody from the outside, and he's, you know, his due diligence consists of nagging some other person to get back to him with the question, do I actually have a serious jury ex parte communication issue or not? Storms finally does get back to him, and I don't know why that isn't something that would fit within subpart D of the statute.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, there is no evidence that Moore nagged Storms in any
respect. Well, there's inferential
evidence
from the letter where Storms apologizes
for not getting back to him sooner.
And it seems to me that suggests that, for all I know, there are telephone calls. Prisoners don't have, you know, unlimited ways to get in touch with the outside world.
Well, I think in order to show that he exercised due diligence to timely file his claim, Your Honor, he would be required to show that there was some barrier in that respect. But I'd like to go back before that, Your Honor, and I apologize because my brief did not sufficiently emphasize this very important fact, that during trial, and this is in Moore's own, Moore at his post-conviction was his own counsel. So when he testified, he did so in what they characterize as narrative form, and it was essentially a mixture of argument and his own testimony, his own account of what happened. He stated at the post-conviction hearing, and this is in the petitioner's supplemental record, that he strenuously objected when he was informed at trial that the trial court had responded to a jury note in an ex parte fashion. Counsel joined with him in this objection. He explained to the court that he thought that that was central to his defense because it was alibi testimony. And at that time, he knew that error had occurred. Now,
well, he doesn't. All he knows is there's an ex parte communication. But if, as you argue, there's a harmless error component to this, if the judge had said certain things, nobody would ever have found error. If the judge had said, disregard the testimony of witness A, then we would agree there was error. It's all about the content of the communication once you layer in the harmless error concept.
To the degree of colorability, I agree, Your Honor. And I think I have to point out that at that point, he could have filed what is known in Indiana as a Davis-Hatton petition, foregone direct appeal to pursue post-conviction relief first, during which he could have employed discovery techniques to investigate the claim further.
That's asking a lot, isn't it? I mean,
this is after he graduated from the University of Indiana.
Well, Your Honor, I appreciate your comment in that respect. I would urge the court to look at Mr. Moore's conduct of his own post-conviction hearing in the manner in which he cites Indiana post-conviction rules chapter and
right,
verse.
Right, it's in there, but the statute simply requires the factual predicate of the claim to have been discovered through the exercise of due diligence, and all of these elaborate procedures unavailable to somebody without a rather sophisticated knowledge of the law, it strikes me it's just a lot. He gives his testimony in the post-conviction hearing, but in fact he doesn't know until May 18th, 1998, 232 some odd days before the post-conviction petition, that this is what those jurors said. We don't even know if his testimony then would have been the same. The question is he within, by the time you do all the counting rules, is he within a year? And it strikes me that the thing that triggers it all is storms.
I disagree with that, Your Honor. I believe that he had enough to investigate before his conviction was even filed because of what he heard in the trial court.
Well, let me ask you about something. You're not going to get anywhere there, so let's ask you about some more promising avenue for you. Now, is your opponent correct? The reason they arrested him or, you know, suspected him was that he was involved in another police impersonation case?
That is what I could glean from the record that is filed before this court on this appeal, Your Honor. I did not look at the direct appeal record in respect, well, at all. I did not see testimony regarding...
But it is true he was prosecuted for another police impersonation.
Correct, Your Honor. That was in Madison County, Indiana, as opposed to Clinton County, Indiana, that this case stems from.
In the academic sense, how can you conclude that a communication, ex parte communication, was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt when there is no record of the communication? Just an acknowledgement that there was one.
There was testimony, Your Honor, at the post-conviction hearing and the affidavit submitted as evidence to inform the post-conviction court of the party's two different characterizations and the juror's own account of what occurred.
Every case that discusses the possibility of a finding of harmless error is one in which all the conversation has been on the record. The judge's communications have been a matter of record, either written in the form of questions and answers or a court reporter's statement. Can you think of any case where we simply rely on some judge later on saying, by the way, I talked to the jurors and I told them the right thing?
Judge, I do not know of any cases. I
neither
don't know
do I.
Cases to either effect. Now, in this record, there was a completion of
letter. Is there an affidavit from the judge?
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think
so what did he say?
She stated that Basically, she set forth what the routine procedure was for responding to that type
of... Yeah, I know, but what did she say she did in this case?
I think she indicated that she followed those procedures.
Is it the procedure in Indiana that when there's a communication from the jury to the judge, that the judge handles it without any discussion with either defense or prosecutor?
Or if the judge is going to answer, the judge would bring the parties into the courtroom before it did.
Well, the judge did answer.
And the judge did conduct an ex parte communication, Your Honor. Yeah, there's no argument about
that. So she didn't follow the...
She followed what she stated was her routine procedure in her courtroom.
Ah, it is not routine procedure in Indiana. It's her procedure.
She said, Your Honor, that what she did was respond to the note in writing.
The jury? Why don't get to the point? What did she say to the jury?
She responded to the jury to rely on its own answers. But I'm not sure that her order states that.
I'm not sure. And you've lost me completely. What do you mean her order didn't say? Is that what she said to the jury?
Her order.
Rely on your own answers. Is that it?
Your Honor, jurors testified to that effect. Her order stated.
Not her order. What did her affidavit say?
That is the affidavit, Your Honor. I'm sorry. I'm confusing the terminology. The order was in response to the motion.
What did she say to the jury? Would you just let me...
She didn't say that in her affidavit.
So in other words, she didn't tell us what she said to the jury. Is that what you're trying to say?
I think that the reading of the order leaves you still not knowing what the content of the response was judge's own words.
That was my impression as well.
But I think something significant here.
Well, why didn't someone ask her to tell, put in an affidavit or an order, if you want to call it an order, what she said?
Judge, I don't disagree with you that would have been far the better course. I think my time is up. May I address the court briefly further? Something that's very significant, too, about the order on the motion for completion of record is that this was in response to a motion that was filed by petitioner on February 27th of 1998, which was almost 3 months before he received his response from Storm. He was not relying on Storm to...
Are you back to that? Are you? You're back to that timeliness issue? Time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Miller, does he have any more time? Mr. Hiller, sorry.
30 seconds.
How much time does he have? 30 seconds? All right.
Your Honor, excuse me, I'm sorry.
Nothing.
Your Honor, I'd like to address one point raised in the state's argument. The objection that Moore makes at trial, and he discusses in his narrative at post-conviction, is important because it's the only account of the ex parte communication in the record before you, other than the juror affidavits, but it's the only live court account. And in that account, Moore states that he did object, his trial counsel objects. That never appears in the record. The objection doesn't appear. The note doesn't appear in the record.
Well, the communication doesn't appear in the record either.
That's correct.
The whole thing is a blur.
And it's also important to stress that the bailiff delivered her answer verbally. This was not a written response. So with that...
Okay, well, thank you very much. And you were asked to represent this, right, by the court?
That's correct.
Yes, so we thank you for your efforts on behalf of your...
Thank you.